Welcome back to another episode of our Movie Business Podcast series, where we look to make sense of the current trends in the film and television industry. My name is Ilan Haimov, and I'm a partner and a department head of the Profit Participation Group here at GHJ. And in this podcast episode, I'm joined by Jason Squire, Professor Emeritus at USC School of Cinematic Arts, as well as the editor of the Movie Business Book, fourth edition, to discuss with our guest, Raymond Zhao, on the current trends with the film industry in China. Jason will introduce, as usual, our guest, Raymond in this case, and get us going with our discussion. Jason, please take it from here.
Thanks so much, Ilan. Raymond Zhao Liming, is the foremost English and Chinese bilingual film and theater scholar and critic, previously based in China, with extensive experience in teaching, consulting, journalism, and public appearances. The Los Angeles Times called him the Roger Ebert of China. He served as executive editor-in-chief, China Daily Online, as senior columnist and editor, China Daily, China's national English language newspaper, and later as a film executive, executive vice president of Legendary East. Raymond has conceived, moderated, hosted, or guested at some 300 forums, including at both the Beijing and Shanghai International Film Festival. I was honored to do a Q&A with him for students and faculty at Beijing Film Academy. Welcome, Raymond.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for your invitation.
Well, thank you. So let's turn first to the highlights of recent China film history that have led us to its success.
Well, we all know that the Chinese film industry, most specifically the theatrical side of the business, has been smashing records. Last year in 2020, it came out as the champion in terms of box office results. And this year it looks like it will at least take a couple of top spots in terms of the number one movie or the top three movie. But let me remind you, there is one record it's never going to smash, and that is attendance. Because in 1979, China had 30 billion in attendance. Not exactly tickets, because at that time, free screenings in rural areas were very common, and it was not, the 30 billion is not an exact number, it was approximate. But there was a wider or a different definition of almost everything when it comes to the film industry. So when we talk about China's film industry, I should specify that we are actually talking about this century, the 21st century. Because when someone, a youngster says, I just went and watched a movie, it was very different from when his grandfather said, I went to watch a movie 40 years ago. During the grandpa's generation, it could be applied to any hall or even outdoor spaces, such as a white wall or a plaza wide enough to erect an ad hoc screen. But starting from this century, we have multiplexes in shopping malls. Actually, shopping mall was a pretty new notion that appeared this century. So when I took Jason to the Wanda Mall in Beijing, I'm sure it looked very much like an American movie theater, but it looked totally different from a movie theater in China 30 or 40 years ago. Actually, the industry suffered a big dip, had a huge dip during the late 80s and early 1990s. And it started to climb up gradually by the end of the last century. But just to simplify things, I was use the new century as a cutoff period. So we are talking about this period. And of course, the history of Chinese industry goes back more than 100 years, just like in any other big country. Still a few more things I want to bring up. In 1994, before the cutoff period, China started the import of foreign movies on a revenue sharing basis. At first limiting to 10 a year, and now it's 34 plus another 30 or so for a flat fee. Movies like Terminator 2 and The Fugitive opened the eyes of many in the Middle Kingdom to what a movie experience could be like. It was the kind of experience the proverbial grandpa would never have imagined. And also, the government gradually eased regulations on production, distribution, and exhibition, not to foreign investment, but to domestic non-state-owned entities.
This trend led to the skyrocketing growth of production, distribution, and exhibition, especially the enormous growth of theaters that hasn't seemed to have caught up proportionally to the population quite yet.
Yes, yes, yes. It started very slowly, like the first big domestic film is Zhang Yimou's Hero. It was considered a blockbuster. But the whole year's box office, cumulative box office, would be less than 1 billion yuan, which would be a moderately successful blockbuster today. So everything is changing. And it's changing so fast that the definition of almost everything evolves. You cannot really compare a hit movie today from one from 7 years ago. Say in 2012, there was a movie that I specifically emphasized in my book, A Practical Guide to Chinese Cinema, that was Lost in Thailand. It was a very important movie because it signifies the rise of the genre film. Because film production used to be so strictly state controlled and had nothing whatsoever to do with filmmakers' income. So Chinese filmmakers of the old days actually cultivated a very elitist view of what a film should be. They disdained almost what they called commercial films, that is films designed to make money. In the late 1980s, when these movies first started to appear out of those state-owned studios, someone who made a blockbuster would even be ostracized by his or her peers for selling out, quote unquote. And who would want to be a capitalist pig if they could not make a penny more for themselves? So in the early years of the new century, when genre movies started to gain more of a positive image, the industry found it was not easy to make such a movie. So they had to bring in talents from Hong Kong who were more fluent in the language of this formula. So that's why I consider Lost in Thailand as a landmark, because it was the first movie designed by mainland talent to in accordance with the storytelling techniques known around the world, and got an overwhelming response on the Chinese market. It washed away the stigma associated with so-called commercial films. Of course, if you look at it from the perspective of art and culture and prestige, you could also say this movie heralded the downfall of Chinese cinema, because suddenly students in Beijing Film Academy need to concern themselves with what ordinary people like to watch, not just the taste of French arbiters of excellence.
I wanted just to, Raymond, take this a little further and do a comparison, if you can help us, between the China film industry versus Hollywood in terms of how the distribution process works, perhaps how the consumer looks at it from a consumption perspective. Anything that you can share at a high level in terms of what's different, perhaps what's the same. And what comes to mind, as I reflect back, you were both talking about the history, Furious 7, for example, Avatar, some of those titles that kind of come to mind, that it had enormous success in China coming out of Hollywood. It's just amazing how sometimes the reception of these Hollywood titles is just incredible. So anything you can share, Raymond, just to give us a sense of the similarities and the differences between those two.
To suggest that a starting point might be the limiting of non-Chinese movies, non-local language movies distributed in China.
There's always been foreign movies shown in China, even during the 1950s and the 60s, even the 70s, when there were only a dozen or so movies for the whole decade. But when we talk about the influx of foreign movies and its huge cultural and industrial business impact, that started from 1994, when the 10 Hollywood movies, technically they should be just foreign imports, but most of them were Hollywood movies. And they showed the Chinese people and also showed the Chinese industry that movies could be a business. And the big movies from Hollywood accounted for roughly half of China's box office for a long time. But that was, as we all know, was more or less controlled because the government wouldn't want this number to go too high. Sometimes at the end of the year, during November and December, they would say loosen up and show a couple more imports to jack up the percentage. But recently there's a huge difference because with the expansion of the market, with new multiplexes in so-called third tier or fourth tier cities, that is smaller cities and towns far away from those metropolises, the tastes of the audience are very different. They are less likely to watch a Hollywood movie or any other foreign movie than a domestic film that's more or less made in the formula of a Hollywood movie. Actually, Wolf Warrior 2, released in 2017, which still is the biggest movie in China, many saw it as like a Chinese version of the Rambo trilogy. It's very, very similar to the Rambo movies. And also when this year or late last year, I forgot, China re-released The Lord of the Rings, it got a predominantly negative feedback from the audience. And this shocked us, shocked people like me, and shocked a lot of cineasts and film lovers in China, because when it was first shown, it was early in the century. And of course, the total box office was not so high, but it was very positive. It was seen as a milestone in fantasy films. But nowadays, the young people who saw this film for the first time, they may not even have seen it online. They had more or less a blasé feeling, and some even complained that the story did not end with part one. So it became huge news in China. And the Avatar re-release also, and the Avatar was hugely successful the first time around. But last year, after the pandemic, the government re-released Avatar, tried to jack up the market, and it got a very mediocre results, much less than the re-release of the Titanic. I think the re-release of the Titanic got more than 1 billion yuan, which was very, very successful, even by Chinese standards. There are other similarities and differences, and there's one I would like to point out. Many movie theaters in China sell soda and popcorn, but they don't sell movie tickets. You have to use a smartphone to complete the whole buying process, including selecting seats. All you need is to scan the code and print out your ticket at a machine. And nowadays, even that is being done away with, as some cinemas are beginning to take your phone scan directly. And it's the same with train tickets. And also 3D, as we know, 3D is more popular in China and can still command a high ticket price, and maybe more so than here in the States. But things are also changing. Hollywood reports, whose main advantage is special effects, are not as welcome as before. And generally speaking, what sells in America has a large appeal in the Chinese market. I say generally because when it comes to China-related content, things can get very, very tricky. Movies like Crazy Rich Asians and Mulan were met with indifference, if not outright contempt. And I actually foretold that because from a Chinese perspective, it was very clear. Shang-Chi did not even get the green light from the Chinese censors. As I said, Hollywood movies used to account for roughly half of the country's box office, but as more multiplexes are built in smaller cities, the shift in taste is palpable. There was only a few exceptions. Hollywood blockbusters tend to linger around 1 billion yuan mark, which is around $155 million. While Chinese blockbusters have repeatedly broken through the 3 billion yuan milestone, which is $465 million. And there is only one foreign film above that mark, and that is Avengers Endgame. Of course, there are many reasons for Hollywood movies did not do as well as some had expected, but demographic change is a key factor. There is a trend in the aftermath of COVID-19, which closed down cinemas across China for exactly half a year. After they were reopened, film-going patterns seemed to shift towards a few tentpoles. And of course, those tentpoles were mostly Chinese. Big titles that opened in the so-called golden weeks, and that is the week-long October 1st National Day holiday and the Lunar New Year holidays at the beginning of the year, would get very, very big, bigger than pre-pandemic. So far, four titles have grossed over 3 billion yuan, which is about 500 million US, a little less than that. But on regular days and on regular weekends, movie attendances have been so low that for many theaters, it probably loses more money by keeping them open than closed. China has just reached the 80,000 screens yard right now. I think it was last week. And the slowest days translate to less than 10 tickets sold per screen. So you can figure out that many of these movie theaters are losing money on the regular days. One big difference I have noticed is Chinese streamers do not want to compete with the exhibition sector. Instead, they want movie theaters to flourish, because only titles that do well theatrically would attract a sizable audience online. If a movie is given to a streamer exclusively and get a big audience online, it would never become a phenomenon or an event similar to a blockbuster or a big streaming series. So far, the highest grossing feature film made exclusively for streamers made around 50 million yuan. And given their preferential cut, they usually get half instead of one third from theaters. That would be tantamount to about 150 million yuan in box office revenue. And that is about, 23 million US. So it's a medium-sized film at best. Any movie with a budget above the convenient 100 million yuan will definitely not think of giving it to a streamer first, because it does not make business sense.
It's a vibrant industry that any movie lover would very much enjoy following the progress. And so it's such a bonus for you to be with us. The number of screens hitting 80,000 makes it almost double the US screens. Of course, the China population is something like three times that of the population of the United States. And the industry in China is thriving with local language movies, which is very healthy for any market. The foreign language movies, including Hollywood movies, are limited to about, 30 or 35 titles a year, determined by the government. And the government also decides when they should be released. So that especially is a very big difference compared to the Hollywood system around the world.
The maximum number of imports is 34, but there are very detailed regulations. What kind of they encourage more like IMAX and 3D movies. And on top of that, actually on the usual year, pre-pandemic, there would be 30 more so-called flat fee movies, imported movies. So to add up, it would be around 70 foreign films. But the flat fee movies have been doing less and less well in recent years. It reached a landmark when the Indian film Dango made 1.5 billion yuan at the box office out of the blue. Nobody knew that. It's just a wide gamble. And so private companies would try to snatch up titles from different countries just in the hope that it will turn out to be a surprise hit, but it's happening less and less often.
Wow. Well, now, can we turn to your prognosis for the China industry going forward?
The industry, as I see it, is in a very strange place. On the one hand, it is given more and more prominence, maintaining public image and shaping public opinions. On the other hand, it seems regulators are not so sure how to define it. In the old days, it was a propaganda tool existing to serve ideology. Then starting from the late 20th century, the idea that it could be a business, just like any other business, started to take root. Now we are seeing a gradual turnaround, so to speak, which could have deep ramifications down the road. In a very short term span, just a few years, China overtook North America as the market with the most screens. Mind you, only a handful of these existed 20 years ago, and even those were so heavily redecorated and reconfigured that not a trace of the old venues are left. But to fill these screens with popular movies is another matter. The pandemic brought a special unintended experiment. First, Hollywood put much of its slate of new releases on hold, and then there were at that time, there were last year, there were almost no big titles from Hollywood on China screens. And then this year, Hollywood started to get back to normal, but China was held importing Hollywood tentpoles, watching cinemas being empty month after month. If the trend continues, the glory of the world's most screens may not hold because China cannot produce enough runaway hits like the recent Battle of Lake Changjin or Hai Mom from this year's Lunar New Year to fill out the whole year. And of course, the purpose of this policy, if it is a policy, is to encourage more domestic output, domestic hits. In the absence of Marvel titles and other imported options, more popular domestic hits may emerge in abundance, and that's a good thing. Theoretically, if China could produce 20 big movies with each grossing 3 billion yuan, that will add up to a whole year's box office output pre-COVID. The paradox is if you believe you have a potential blockbuster on hand, you would insist on going for one of the two golden weeks rather than being content with a regular weekend. And if everyone goes for the same slot, such as the 7 tentpoles for this past year's Lunar New Year season, actually only 2 won out. The other 5 were losers. And some of them actually could have fared better if they had opted for a regular weekend.
What are the 2 golden weeks? Just sorry for interrupting.
First one is from October 1st to October the 7th. That's the National Day weekend. Mm-hmm. It's 7 days long. And this year, the biggest movie is Battle of Lake Changjin, which has so far brought in about 710 million US dollars, and it's projected to reach 840 million US by the end of its run. And the other golden week is the Lunar New Year, which could fall on late January or early or mid February, because the lunar calendar. And I remember before the Lunar New Year started, there were as many as like 12 or 14 big titles announced that they were open on this day. And half of them withdrew at last minute. So seven ended up competing for this biggest season, biggest slot of the year, and only two won out. The other five were deemed losers, but losers in terms of box office. Some of them got pretty good reviews, but they still lost out.
Raymond, I've got a quick follow-up question, and maybe this is where we're going to close. Do you see China perhaps become a destination for production, not necessarily distribution? So I'm curious if you have a sense as to whether the Chinese government may want to look for ways to encourage and incentivize Hollywood studios to bring production more and more to China, as we currently do, right, in Canada or Australia or New Zealand and other territories with favorable tax arrangements.
I don't see it coming. But also I see a divergent view because private investors and operators such as Wanda would definitely welcome foreign productions. Wanda built a huge studio complex in Qingdao, its home city. Not exactly its home city, but it's one of its major bases. And they were certainly, they actually gave a lot of incentives to the legendary production. Regulators will see it another way, because they would demand script approval, which is not something very convenient. I know some art house films, they don't even have scripts, and they would have very strict rules about what kind of movies could be made. So China definitely have the infrastructure to make movies, even like big properties like the Game of Thrones. I'm sure they can build up something to look like Iceland or whatever. A lot of people in China, they didn't know that Wolf Warrior 2, which is mostly set in Africa, was shot in China. It was not shot in Africa. They built the whole African village in China. It was quite authentic. So it could be done technically, but regulators will see it very differently. They want full control of the whole thing, the story, the dialogue, everything. And they will probably not see eye to eye with either Hollywood producers or producers from any other countries to do so. But actually, it's funny that since you brought up this point, the reverse trend is happening. A lot of Chinese big productions are moving offshore. There is one big franchise called Detective Chinatown, helmed by a very young star turned director, Chen Sicheng. And he has found a secret to set all his Chinese stories in Southeast Asia. And by that, he has conveniently bypassed a lot of the restrictions that's imposed on stories and movies in China. And the films can be shown across China, but the stories theoretically took place in Thailand or Indonesia or some other place, or the last time in Tokyo and before that in New York.
Wow, quite interesting.
Yeah.
I think at this time, we're gonna go ahead and close. We really, on behalf of Jason and myself, Raymond, again, thank you for taking the time to share more insight into the movie industry in China.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.